Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:34 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is July 21st, and it has been a particularly eventful week. And of course, this was Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And this has been a week in which an increasingly large number of global stock markets have been hitting new all-time highs. This has also been a week in which oil prices have been reasonably firm, but they're pulling back from that psychological $50 level in here today. Their Brent crude, for example, is down almost $1.50, back to $47.88. Then it's been a reasonably firm week for the precious metals. Gold is back above $1,250, and that's the first time in at least a month that it's been able to surmount that level. And there's increasing evidence of a broad-based rally in commodities outside of the energy sector. The industrial metals have been rallying, even the soft commodities, which have been among the weakest in the commodity complex, have also been rallying. When we look at the bond markets, it has been reasonably quiet. This has also been a week in which the ECB has begun to hint, although they have been very eager to keep their options open, but they have been hinting about tapering potentially in the third quarter. So that has acted as something of a tailwind for the euro. The euro is currently at 116.70, and that is the highest level that we've seen for the euro in almost 2 years. Then the Australian dollar up to almost 80 cents and getting some consolidation. And this was also an eventful week for Bitcoin. So there really is a lot to talk about, and most particularly to try and put all of these events in the medium to longer term context, which I believe is useful from the perspective of the medium to long term investor. Let's start off first with the Dow Gold Ratio, because that really does give us the really long-term history. There are a couple of things that I think are the most important points on this chart. The first is that there is over 30 years between peaks. When we look at the peak in 1929, the peak in 1965, and the peak in 1999, then we have an average of about 34 years. It would suggest that if the rhythm of this chart continues, the next peak is going to be somewhere around 2033. If the progression of higher highs remains intact, then the next peak is going to be above 45. And that would represent that the value of the Dow Jones will be 45 times the value of gold. Gold is currently at $1,250. I'll let you do the math, but it is a value for the Dow Jones that is multiples of where it is today. Then we also have evidence from this long-term ratio that bull markets in stocks last longer than bull markets in gold. That bull markets in gold tend to represent periods of time which are associated with lengthy periods of underperformance by stocks. The stocks generally tend to go sideways, and gold then outperforms in a dramatic manner. That was certainly the case all the way from 1999 until 2011. It was a 12-year bull market. If we look back at the bull market in precious metals most particularly the outperformance of precious metals relative to the Dow Jones from 1965 to 1980, it was a 15-year bull market. So this most recent bull market has been somewhat shorter than the last one. But then if we look at the massive crash that we saw in 1929 in stocks, the outperformance of gold didn't last more than a couple of years. So the more important point is that these bull markets in equities tend to last decades. And this one only really started to get legs and start running in 2011. And that was the reason that I was really inspired to write Crowd Money. It was because I saw so many of these long-term bases that were looking increasingly likely that they were going to break out. I only published the book in 2013 because it took me 2 years to write it. I hope I'm trying to write another book right now. Hopefully it's not going to take me another 2 years. I'm about 20,000 words into it, and I hope it's not going to be more than 80,000 words long. So let's say I'm a quarter of the way through it. Or if I wrote yesterday about the experience my kids have had with Khan Academy, that I've done the easy part and I have to get over the hump. The writing the end of it is usually the easy part as well. Now getting back to topic. When we think about what the upside potential is for equities, then we are currently in 2017, and if the next peak in this ratio is going to be in 2033, we've got 16 years in the upside. It is not going to go up in a straight line. That is perhaps the most important factor. Now let's look at some of these big or long-term charts for some of the world's biggest indices. So we don't look at the Wilshire 5000 particularly often, but it's a reasonable proxy for the entire US stock market. And it completed a lengthy range in 2012. And it then had a reasonably large consolidation and found support in the region of that psychological 20,000 level, and then really has exploded higher over the last couple of years. And there is no sign yet that it has stopped going up. Is it somewhat overbought in the short term? On this long-term chart, I think we'd have to say yes, but let's zoom in a little bit and look at it on a weekly basis. Then the pace of the advance has been much more moderate, and it is very steady on the upside. It is almost a mirror of the S&P 500 with these step sequence uptrend since the beginning of 2016. And that, as long as that remains the case, as long as we get a step and a breakout and a step and a breakout, and as long as that rhythm in the market persists, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. A consistent trend is a trend in motion, and a consistent trend is one that is quite easy to identify what the consistency characteristics are. And as long as those consistency characteristics continue to repeat and the rhythm of the market persists, then there is no reason to question the potential for additional upside. Then we just have to ask ourselves the filter questions. If we know what the consistency characteristics are, then is there evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend endings? And the answer is no. And as long as the answer remains no, well, then there is no reason to call a top. That's one of the things I think that is most important to bear in mind. Then, if we look at the, I think there is an additional point, and I think it will be borne out when, for example, we look at the MSCI World Index, which broke out to new all-time highs in January. Now, that represents some significant temporal leadership by US indices. If the MSCI World is only breaking up to new high ground in January of this year, it would suggest that the real leadership in this market is coming out of Wall Street. That the US was the most proactive in terms of its monetary policy after the credit crisis, and then it was also one of the most active in forcing the financial sector to absorb their losses, to write them off. That was particularly painful for consumers who were involved in the foreclosure crisis. But the net result is that news this week is that banks are actually at higher, have actually surmounted their profitability from back in 2007, and that is despite the fact that they are dealing in an environment where there has been a great deal of additional regulation imposed upon them. But the MSCI World is breaking upwards to new high ground, and again, there is no evidence that this breakout has yet ended. So that also suggests that we are in a broad-based rally. Now, the FTSE 100 is the largest of well, that's let me rephrase that. The UK is the largest capital market in Europe, and the FTSE 100 represents the largest shares in it. And it ranged for 17 years and then broke out. And if we look back at the last two charts we've looked at and these lengthy consolidations that are then completed are resolved on the upside, then that has generally been the hallmark of the beginning of a new bull market. Not a simple short-term bull, but a medium-term or even potentially long-term bull. So now the FTSE is following the lead of the US and indeed the MSCI World. And that's important because when we look at the Europe Stoxx 600 and the fact that it has been ranging below that psychological 400 level since early 2000, the fact is that there are over 200 UK listed shares in this index, and that represents a significant weighting. The fact that the S&P 500, excuse me, the FTSE 100 has already broken out, that suggests that it is only a matter of time before the Europe Stoxx 600 can also surmount this 400 level and that it has catch-up potential. If we strip out the influence of markets like the UK or Switzerland, Sweden, Denmark, or Norway, and simply look at the euro-denominated portion of that index, well then it is way below its peak. But nonetheless, it does continue to represent a market that has catch-up potential. So Europe is emerging out of what must have felt like Hades, that the market had gone down so much that it was almost in the underworld. And now the fact is that growth is starting to recover, and not least because the ECB has pumped 2 trillion euros into the Eurozone economy. And that is having a similar effect on Europe as it did in anywhere else that it's been employed, which is that it is helping to inflate asset prices. So that is, I think, the one of the things for in Europe's favor is that they do have catch-up potential. Now, we should also take a look at the topics, because the topics index has been ranging below 1750 since 1991, and that feels like an awfully long time. I think the most important thing on this chart is that every time it got up to 1750, it fell back and made a new low. We have ample evidence of that in here, where you see that it got up to 1750, made a new low, 1750, made a new low, 1750, made a new low, and it didn't do that back in 2016. It posted its first higher reaction low, major higher reaction low, and is now back testing that previous peak. Now, the dollar has been quite weak. The yen has been strengthening up this week. But if the topics can take out the 1750 level, then we would have no other choice than to conclude that Japan's stock market is back in not just a short-term bull market, not just short-term steadying, but potentially a medium or even longer-term bull market. It has been an awfully long time since one could make a credible argument that there was more than short-term steadying going on, or that we were getting more than a cyclical bull. There have been spectacular cyclical bull markets in Japan, not least between about 2003 and 2005, or between about 2012 and early 2016. But if it can sustain a move above 1750, we could be in a very different environment, and that could even see the previous peak getting taken out. That's a potential that is not beyond the bounds of the imagination at all, and yet it is something that I think Japanese investors have given up, even considering that it is even potentially possible. The second section index, which has so often been a lead indicator for the Japanese market, is already at a new all-time high. It was able to make a new all-time high back in early 2006 as well, but it has surmounted the 600, six, excuse me, 6,000 level over the last few weeks. There is no questioning the fact that it is overbought in the short term, but the reality is that it is at a new high, and that represents a clear outperformance of the small cap sector in Japan. And these are the companies that have benefited least from offshoring. So they are more reliant on the domestic Japanese economy than just about anything else. The fact that they are outperforming, that's really quite positive. When we look at what's happening with the yen, then it has been firming up this week. It is back testing this 111 area against the dollar. 110 is a psychological resistance level that ha and it has failed around that level twice in so far this year, but it's going to have to do more than that. The dollar is going to have to break upwards against the yen to really perhaps lend that additional tailwind to the Japanese equity market that would could push it up and out of this long-term range. If we stick with the looking at some of the largest indices out there, then what's happening in China is, I think, really noteworthy right now. There is a massive political transition going on right now, and the administration is increasingly sensitive to any threat to the status quo. There are so many different facets to China that it is rather difficult to draw a single conclusion. So I'm going to just reach the conclusion first and then talk about maybe some of the other points later. They don't want anything to affect the status quo, and the stock market is one of the things that could affect the status quo, so therefore the likelihood is that they're going to try and support it. The I've believed for at least the last year, and veteran subscribers will certainly have heard me say this previously, that I believe that this range on the A-share index is largely manufactured, that they are trying their utmost to quell volatility out of the A-share index. And the banking sector is a major constituent of the A-share index, and it has been rallying. Now, it was in negative territory today, and it is a bit overbought in the short term, so we could see some potential for some consolidation, and that could feed through into the A-share index simply going sideways. But the reality is that they don't want to see a big decline, and if there was the threat of a larger decline, we could anticipate there would be support for the market. And I think that that is perhaps what is beginning to be exhibited when we look at the H-share market in Hong Kong, that it has been trending higher in a very consistent manner since the beginning of 2016. And it moved to a new recovery high this week. It didn't quite hold it, but a sustained move below that psychological 10,000 level would really be required to begin to question that this isn't rallying from the lower side of what is so far an almost 8-year range. And the Hang Seng index, which has been, I think, off the radar for a significant period, has cleared the 25,000 level. It wasn't quite able to hold that break above 25,000 back in 2015. It went right back down and tested the lower side of the range, but now it is clearing it once more, and a sustained move below that 25,000 level would be required to question potential for additional upside. This is another really globally well-known index that is clearing an important area of resistance. So that also fits rather well into this story about synchronized global economic expansion. News this week, before I go to India, some of the news that was coming out about China this week was that economic growth surprised on the upside, that the administration, as part of its efforts to try and clamp down on anything that would affect the status quo, has been I think the perhaps the best way to describe it is that they have been telling the people that are selling wealth protection products that they're going to have to start offering lower yields. They're trying to clamp down on the tacit guarantees that some of these products have. They have been investigating companies that have been aggressively borrowing money and investing abroad, like Wanda or Anbang Insurance. And those are also, rather than looking at that in terms of what it implies in terms of authoritarianism, but rather perhaps look at it in the vein in which it is primarily intended, which is to clamp down on anything that would affect the status quo. Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang are going to be, and it is still, I think, largely questionable whether Wang Qishan is going to be reinstated. He is older than the mandatory retirement age, so whether he is going to be a member of the standing committee after the September or October meeting is very much open to question. It would require an exception to be made on his behalf. If th that being the case, the The standing committee has got 7 seats, and that could potentially mean that 5 of them are going to be open. The Politburo, from which the standing committee is chosen, 40% of the seats in it are going to be vacant and need to be filled. So when we think about the status quo in China, the people at the top echelons of the Communist Party, this is what they're primarily focused on, is that who is going to be filling those seats, who is going to have the greatest influence. This is a almost once in decades chance for the highest power in China to cement their influence that will persist well beyond Xi Jinping's personal premiership. The last person who was able to achieve that was Jiang Zemin, and this is a major transition going on in China. So the Communist Party is at pains to ensure that nothing happens to really upset confidence in the system. And that represents a potentially bullish factor for stock markets because it de-risks it. And that would suggest that China has the potential to outperform into September, October, when then we could have this sort of buy the rumor, sell the news type of environment. So I do think that China is probably worth keeping an eye on between now and September, October. Now, if we look at India, the Nifty index is creeping up towards the psychological 10,000 level. But the most important thing it has done in the last 2 years is break up out of that range. And the Indian market remains one of the best potential outcomes for stock market upside potential of anything, because you have improving governance, you have the fact that the rupee has broken its downtrend, and shown here it is that the dollar has broken its uptrend against the rupee, that the rupee is strengthening in here this week. And if we were to take the labels off the chart, what this looks like is a completed type 2 top formation. You have the massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend, that you had that acceleration back in 2003. You got all the way back up and tested the peak. So if we were to actually look at it over the last 4 years, this is an evolving type 3 top, where you get ranging time and size. And the most important thing is that the dollar is now trading below the trend mean. And India is in something of a sweet spot. And Reliance in Industries is, I think, a rather interesting chart. It went sideways for what must have felt like a very long time. They spent an awful lot of money on building a 4G infrastructure, and that really went live at the beginning of this year. And the stock has pretty much done nothing but go up since. And it represents an almost sea change in what's available in India. That prior to this, mobile phones were pretty much ubiquitous, but internet connectivity was 2G. And going from 2G to 4G, if you remember the first time you had a 2G phone, the internet was so slow as to be largely useless. And now you think about how quickly it runs on 4G and the number of apps that you have that can function, that you can have online banking. Online banking is a profound change for countries like India and indeed most of Africa, because you can access your phone with your thumbprint, and even a 2-year-old can use a smartphone. 2-year-olds are illiterate, and there are large numbers or millions of people in India who are illiterate, but that doesn't mean they can't use a smartphone. And if they have a smartphone that they can access with their thumbprint, then they have the ability to have bank accounts. They can have access to financial services. That represents really an incredible innovation. That's the kind of thing that could really drive growth in India well beyond the short term. The application of technology, the fact that we're getting that this is an environment where technology being developed in one country goes global instantly, but that what it does for emerging markets is allow them to skip whole segments of the infrastructure build out that usually had taken decades previously. Can you imagine how much money it takes to develop a branch network for banks in a country with 1.3 billion people? Whereas if you have a 4G network and everyone has a smartphone, you can have a national banking network in 3 or 4 months. So that is the kind of innovation that is really driving the growth potential, not just in India, but in just about all these developing countries. And that is also feeding through in the energy sector. Oil prices have been in a very volatile range over the last couple of years. And they posted their first higher reaction low a couple of weeks ago. They got up to test that $50 area yesterday, but it was not able to hold, and now we're getting this downward dynamic in here today. It suggests that we are still in this choppy, rangy environment. There was the potential that if it could have bounced and sustained a move above $50, that we could have had the beginnings of an uptrend, but so far that has not happened, and this remains a very challenging environment. But if we think about this in terms of the very long term, this index is monthly and it is only updated on the 30th of each month, so it's only going to go up to June 30th. But if we now look at this on a long-term basis, and we look at it on a logarithmic scale chart, which will smooth out some of the variability, and I'm going to take it all the way back to 1900. Well, what this does is gives us a picture of these steps that, and let me just pull this down so that, whoops, so that we can see the lower side here. This is around 1900, where we'd had a big bull market in the oil price, and then it did nothing at all until 1971, and then we had a big bull market, and it did really not much of anything until 2004. Then we had a big bull market, and subsequently it hasn't really been doing much of anything. Now, what I think are the main points about this is that the oil market is capable of major bulls, that it and these bull markets can persist for relatively lengthy periods of time. But the oldest adage in the commodity markets is that the cure for high prices is high prices, and that the higher prices go, the greater the incentive is to go out and explore and invest in additional supply. And when that additional supply hits the market, it overwhelms demand, no matter how quickly demand is increasing, and that contributes to a secular bear market. And those secular bear markets can last decades. If the last peak was in 1981 and it didn't really break out until 2004, we're talking 23 years. If this one was 1949 and it didn't break out until 1971, well, then we're talking about 32 years. That would suggest that it could be upwards of, let's just say, 27, 28 years before oil prices break out above their old high again. And that takes us from 2008 out to potentially 2035. So that's a substantial bear market. But what can we tell from previous bear markets is that the volatile ranging means that the trough to peak swings have been in excess of 100%. And we've already seen evidence of that the low was in the 30s, and then the peak, excuse me, the low was just below 30, and the peak was up to 60. That's 100% swing from trough to peak. And that is probably going to be the norm in terms of the volatility that we can expect from the energy markets going forward. That occasionally we will have war, occasionally there will be supply outages that could potentially even see prices get briefly up to $100 before falling back, because the quantity of additional oil that becomes economic in the region of $60 is quite impressive. But the quantity of oil that becomes economic at $100 is more than ample to supply the global market. And if we start thinking about what would take oil prices above up to new high ground, well, then we also have to begin to factor in inflation. Inflation right now is practically non-existent. It is practically impossible that inflation is going to remain this low for the next 30 odd years. And that's why we should really start thinking about where are we in terms of the bond bull market. Bond yields have been coming down since 1981, and the pace of that decline has moderated, and not least because yields have come down so much already. The 10-year yield in the US has been ranging for 5 years already, but a sustained move above 3% would at least break the progression of lower rally highs. But that's probably not yet enough, because we have had periods of time where the progression of lower rally highs has been broken before. But a sustained move above 4% would really begin to confirm that we are in a very different environment. And in a major bull market, the strategy that works best is buy and hold. And in buy and hold, the strategy that supplements it is to buy the dips. And if one had bought the dips in US Treasuries, pretty much you could not have lost money in on a total return basis over the last 20 something odd years. So now we're looking at the total return on Treasury futures. And the key, I think the absolute no nonsense, absolute conclusion we could make, if this index breaks its progression of higher reaction lows, then the buy the dip strategy will have stopped working. And if you think about anywhere you've ever worked, when do people start to question the winning strategy? Well, it isn't when it's working. It's usually when it stops working. And when it stops working, that's when people start to go for the door. That's when people start really thinking about what they're going to do and how they're going to manage the new scenario. So if I zoom in to a weekly chart, this index has been rallying for most of this month already. And it has held a progression of higher reaction lows since December. This is still an uptrend. It would really need to take out the low from early July to begin to suggest that we're back in a supply-dominated environment. There is still a great deal of argument in the bond markets about whether we're going to have an inflationary or a deflationary outcome. The deflationists argue, largely correctly, that there has been an absence of the kind of inflation that central banks measure. The inflationists have saying, well, just you wait, that it is only a matter of time, that the economy is already at almost full capacity, the labor market is already at full capacity, and that it is only a matter of time before inflation starts to rise once more, and it will be led by wages. We are already beginning to see that commodity price inflation is picking up. And commodity prices rising are a factor of that we went through an incredible rationalization in terms of supply, and that all of the expansion plans were cancelled. So that as the global economy starts to pick up pace, and this synchronized period of global economic expansion persists, then that should start to contribute to higher prices, which will eventually contribute to commodity businesses investing in additional supply once more. And but in the meantime, that also is going to help inflationary pressures rise. We've often talked about oil prices representing a headwind to economic growth. Well, oil prices, energy prices, are unlikely to represent the existential threat to economic growth anytime soon. There is just too much supply around right now. There is too much indecision among those that have got a big influence in controlling that supply. And in the meantime, independent producers in the US, and not least in the shale sector, are well hedged and have got ample access to liquidity to fund their operations. What is interesting, though, is that wheat prices have been rallying. Now, they broke emphatically higher earlier this year, and they have been pulling back, and they've bounced this week from around that $5 area. Rather than thinking about, oh well, is the price going to come back to $4.60, or is it, the more important point is that if wheat prices hold this breakout and then additionally push higher from here, it means that the price of bread just about everywhere is going to rise. And it was at rising bread prices was one of the contributing factors to the rise of the Arab Spring in Tunisia. Energy prices surging higher can contribute to recessions, but the price of food surging higher can contribute to social unrest. That's less of a factor in the developed markets, but it is a significant factor in the emerging markets, so therefore it is worth keeping an eye on. When we think about the medium term, then this the return to performance of cyclicals like the commodity complex, and I'll just put up the FTSE 350 mining index because it is a reasonable proxy for the global resources sector. The fact that it is bouncing from the region of the trend mean following what was a 6 month consolidation that followed a very impressive rebound last year, this is all quite positive. The technology sector is also cyclical, and the return to performance of the biotechnology sector, the fact that it is surging to push, well, I think surging might be a bit of an exaggeration, but it has rallied to post a new recovery high in here today is really quite encouraging that this is potentially the technology sector that is likely to do best over the next few months. And then, if we look at the banking sector generally has perhaps better quality earnings than the mining sector, but it is also equally cyclical. And that is continues to consolidate following a very impressive advance late last year. The fact that these three sectors are moving back to positions of outperformance following what had been really quite unimpressive performances over the last few years, that's generally an indication that we are in the latter stages of an expansion. But when we think about is when we say latter stages of an expansion, that doesn't necessarily mean that it is going to end tomorrow. Rather, it perhaps means that we're closer to the end than we are to the beginning. That's not much of a that's not much of a prediction, considering that this market has been going up already since 2009. What I'm doing right now is I'm creating the yield curve spread, and what that gives us is a clear indication of the liquidity situation. So we have the 10-year minus the 2-year, and perhaps the most important thing is that conditions were highly accommodative back in 2010, 2011. They were at record highs, and this spread has come in considerably. It is currently close to 90 basis points. The more important point isn't so much that it has come in, but that the trend is downwards. When this spread eventually moves into negative territory, and that's important because it has, when the yield curve spread has become negative, it has been a lead indicator for recessions. So that would suggest that where the spread is right now suggests that there is no chance of a recession anytime soon. and that by the time it does become inverted, that it is generally a lead indicator by at least a year. So that would suggest that we could be a number of years away from the next recession, by which time equity prices could be substantially above where they are now. The fact that we are in the latter stages of the expansion suggests that this is perhaps the most likely point in time where we might anticipate that an acceleration in the performance of stock markets could occur. And it is being led higher by the US, and the US is being led higher by technology. So it is the technology sector that we need to pay greatest attention to for signs of underperformance, but that has not yet occurred. Therefore, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.